and whilst attempting to land, the undercarriage struck a boulder, causing the aircraft to violently crash. Dahl manages to push open the cockpit canopy and escape, crawling out from further harm from the explosion of the plane's fuel tanks and the subsequent machine gun fire unleashed by the heat.
Wow. Welcome to The Compendium, an assembly of fascinating and intriguing things. We are a weekly variety podcast where each week I attempt to tell Adam Cox everything he needs to know about a topic I think he'll find both fascinating and intriguing. We cover topics from the dark corners of true crime, historical events, and incredible people. We give you just enough information to stand your ground at any social gathering. But this week, in the driving seat, we have Adam Cox.
Hello, Kyle.
How's it going?
Yeah, good, thank you. I'm back in the driving seat, ready to tell you something both fascinating and intriguing, of course.
Ooh, I just feel glad that I can just put my feet up.
Literally, your feet are up.
My feet are up. But yeah, I can just chill now, man. I've got my cup of tea. I've got my bottle of water. I might have some wine. I might have some chocolate. And I'm just going to hand over to you, man. So, what is the episode today about?
Well, in today's episode of The Compendium, I have for you an assembly of adventure, spies, and some shootle in the skies, a life before snozwangers and quagwinkles.
What the hell are these words? I cannot think. Are we doing Shakespeare or something?
Shakespeare? No, not quite. Do those names or words not ring a bell, anything from your childhood?
I can honestly say no.
Well, they were a clue to a famous author that gave us The Big Friendly Giant.
Okay.
Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Uh-huh.
And James and the Big Giant Peach.
We're talking about Roald Dahl.
We are indeed. He's an international best-selling author with publications in 49 languages. And he's also got connections to World War II, the US President, Walt Disney, Queen Elizabeth, and James Bond.
Oh, did he do it with Queen Elizabeth?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. So it's not that kind of podcast this week.
There's no scandal as such. but his history is really quite fascinating because everyone knows him as the children's author.
Mm-hmm.
But before he became a children's author, there's a whole mystery and spy life and everything that he got up to in World War II.
Really? So he was a spy, was he?
He was, yeah. He's led a very colourful life before he started writing children's books.
He's dead now, though, isn't he?
He is. He died in 1990.
Oh, really? That long ago?
Yeah, quite a while ago.
I thought it was something really more recent than that.
Oh, no, he's been dead for a while.
Oh, God.
But he's most famous for some of those words I mentioned at the beginning, because he came up with over 500 new words by mixing up letters and using kind of funny word tricks like spoonerisms and malapropisms, which involve moving letters of a word around, but it still has the same sort of context.
Right, yeah.
Or he comes up with a word which sounds like another word. So you kind of know what the meaning is, even if he doesn't directly explain what those words are.
Sure, yeah. See, this is why I thought you were talking about Shakespeare, because Shakespeare was also famous for inventing a whole bunch of different words. The only one that comes to mind at this moment in time was like puppy love, as an example. He invented that. But he was notorious for inventing new words. So it's really interesting to see a modern day version of that.
Yeah, and like Shakespeare, some of those words have now entered the English language or the dictionary, like Oompa Loompa, that's now in there.
Oh, really?
And I think Golden Ticket as well, which comes from obviously Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I think
that's not a word though, is it? That doesn't go in the dictionary.
There's something like it, I don't know, the way it is used maybe, like sure. That's your Golden Ticket. So some other words that he came up with, which I think are quite fun, there's lick swishy and delumptious, which would mean tasty.
Brilliant.
And ucky slush and rotsum, which wouldn't be tasty at all.
I see what you mean. Like, they are brand new words that we've never heard before, but it makes sense. When you say the word, I instantly know what it would probably mean.
So let's quiz you on that one. I'm going to give you a word or a few words, and you've got to tell me what you think they mean.
Do it.
Biff squiggled.
Ooh, like bamboozled.
Yep, that's right. Confused or puzzled.
Nice.
If something was darksome.
Something's dark and mysterious and ominous.
Yeah, murky. That'll be it. If someone said exactly.
Well, come on, these are a bit obvious. That is exactly.
Yeah. Okay, fine. But what about gollop?
Ooh, gollop. I golloped him. I ate him in one.
Yeah, so it's a big gulp.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, it's interesting and it's true. It does work, clearly. But before we go into his backstory, I think it's time for...
All the Latest Things! This is the segment of our show where we segue into a brief foray into the fun things we've discovered from the past week. Could be weird facts, strange news, or just an update on what we've been up to.
So Kyle, what have you got for us today?
My All the Latest Things for this week is just basically a reminder that human nature is unchanging. And even considering the amount of time that's gone by in human history, we still really love fart jokes, your mama jokes, and anything that's just, I don't know,
childish,
petty, and, you know, that kind of stuff. So I was reading on Reddit that very recently they discovered a 3,800-year-old Babylonian inscription on a tablet by a student who sent a letter to his mother complaining about the quality of his clothing.
Really?
Yeah, and it's really incredible. And you can imagine like a Babylonian tablet where they've got all these little triangular inscriptions, like hieroglyphics or whatever.
Yeah.
And the content of it is really incredible. Listen to what the letter said. I might butcher some of these words, but it said, "Tell Lady Xenu, Idin Sin sends the following message. May the gods," and I love this name of the god, "Shamash."
Shamash.
Shamash. God Shamash. Marduk. And Idlabrat, keep you forever in good health for my sake. Which is interesting. Like, I hope you are well for my sake.
Otherwise.
Otherwise, yeah. It's so selfish. Yeah. Isn't it? But it goes on to say, from year to year, the clothes of the young gentleman here, meaning at the university that he is studying at or the school, become better. But you let my clothes get worse from year to year. Indeed, you persist in making my clothes poorer and poorer, more scanty. At a time when in our house wool is used up like bread, you have made my clothes poor. The son of Adam Idahim, whose father is only but an assistant to my father, has two new sets of clothes, while you fuss even about a single set of clothes for me, in spite of the fact that you bore me and his mother only adopted him. His mother loves him, while you do not love me."
Wow, he's got some parent issues.
Someone said in the comments, like, yeah, sounds like a teenager if I've ever heard one.
What happened to the good old fashioned, "I hate you, get out of my life"?
Yeah, essentially, this is it. But it just goes to show that even after all the years, thousands of years have gone by, kids don't change. People don't change.
Yeah.
And I think when we visited Pompeii in Italy, it must have been like 10 years ago now, there was all this graffiti that was discovered on the side of some of these buildings. Things like "your mama jokes," like "your mama's so fat," or "your mama can take like a big old hard on." You know what I mean? One was, "I'm giving up on women and only men shall now gain my attention." Basically really? Saying like, I'm giving up on women because all women are like, I don't know.
He's like, that's it. I'm becoming gay. And everyone's looking like, you've always been gay.
You've always been a homo. But yeah, just really fascinating that we still have the same childish mentalities or the same kind of insults that we throw at people.
That's fun,
after all these years.
Although that's a lot more effort to, like, I don't know, inscribe that onto some tablet than just, I don't know, just shouting it.
I guess so. The other thing that I found out this week, which I found really fascinating, do you know what a cicada is?
It's like a cricket or some kind of thing.
It makes... Yeah, when you go to a hot country and you're walking in the early evening, you just hear that like...
Yeah, and that grasshoppery type sound.
So actually, there are like dozens and dozens of different species of cicadas around. And the thing about a cicada is that they will go dormant for a certain period of time. They will lay their eggs and then the larva will exist underground for a set number of years and then they'll come up. And then they'll swarm, they'll mate, and then they'll all die. And then they'll lay their eggs and then that's it. But the interesting thing is, because there's so many different species that are around, they actually... have different times that they'll incubate under the ground so that they don't come up at the same time and then mix or cause like competition for their species in terms of the resources that are around.
Oh, wow.
But what's really fascinating is that who decides what amount of time that they will bury themselves under the ground before mm-hmm. coming up? And what's incredible is that they're really crazy mathematicians, because they will typically incubate using a prime number, because prime numbers are less likely to overlap. So, for example, one of the species will incubate under the ground for 17 years, another one will incubate for 13 years, another one will incubate for like 11 years, 7 years, 5 years, whatever. These are all prime numbers. And they're less likely over time to then have years where they'll overlap amongst each other.
No way.
And this year is one of the years where we're going to have a huge swarm of these cicadas coming out, not in the UK, I think somewhere in America, because it's a rare year where the prime numbers will overlap, and then these two different species will then emerge and will just be swarmed by these different cicadas.
That is fascinating that biology or nature has somehow instilled this in them.
Yeah.
Is that through like trial and error, or did they?
It's got to be trial and error, but it's just incredible that all these different species have picked their own individual prime number, because like, oh, you've got 13. Oh, I'll go for 17, or I'll go for 11. Isn't that just incredible?
It is. It's like the year of the dragon. This is my year.
Yeah, that's
I'm coming
it.
Out.
And I think there's a film that was out called Jeepers Creepers, where there's this weird Mothman kind of creature who comes out every 17 years, and he's based on the circadian rhythm type of thing, where he'll come out every 17 years to hunt and then kill and then go back dormant again. And it's kind of based on that. But isn't that incredible?
It is, yeah. Cool. Fun fact for the week then.
Yep, that's my all the latest things for this week. What have you got for me?
Well, mine's not as educational as that. Mine's more lowbrow.
Obvious.
So remember a few weeks back, I said about there was that couple in the UK that had to give up their garden ornament because
it was a bomb. Yeah.
Well, I've found out this week that a bomb squad was actually called to ER after someone had brought in a bomb to a hospital.
Okay. Jesus.
It was an 88-year-old man with a World War One artillery shell.
Oh, God.
Guess where it was?
In his butt.
Yeah.
Why?
Now, this thing is 8 inches long and 2 inches wide. So it's quite substantial to put that in your bum. And yeah, he was using it for his own fun. And obviously something went wrong. And he went to the hospital with it. But
did it get lost up there?
It didn't get lost. I think he got it, you know, removed okay. But yeah, they had to get this bomb squad in to make sure it wasn't armed before they removed it from him.
But why did he need to go to the hospital? Because he couldn't get it out himself.
Yeah, it got lodged up there.
Oh, don't you just wait till you have a poo?
I guess it doesn't work like that. But I just think the risk of doing that.
Yeah.
And why did he choose that of all things?
But did he know that it was a bomb?
Oh, yeah. He put it up there.
Yeah, but sometimes you just don't think that. You don't know what you're dealing with, right? Sometimes I just go, that would be nice up my bum. And I don't really think about what it is that I'm putting up there.
I'm going to show you a picture of what it looked like.
Oh, my God.
How do you not know that that's...
I mean, like, that looks like a big old rifle bullet.
Exactly. So he did that. And so I thought, how often does this happen? Well, this was in France. A year before that, someone in England did the exact same thing, but from a World War II bomb.
Oh, man.
But he actually used the line, I slipped and fell.
Oh, God. Do you know what? The thing is, though, with these old people, man, they've got some dark shit that they're really into. Mm. I've got a dark story for you.
Oh, God.
If it's appropriate. So I used to have a friend who used to be a rent arrears officer. Mm. And his job was to, like, chase people up for if they were falling back on their rent. But they have a pretty sophisticated kind of computer system. And what would happen is someone would fall behind in the rent, and if they were over a certain age and they hadn't paid their rent for a while, but they had a history of paying their rent on time, it was likely that they were dead in their apartment.
Oh, God.
So they don't waste any time. They showed up with the police, and they knock on the door. There's no answer. They break in, and sure enough, they find the guy. He's died on his bed. But what had happened was that he had died because he was pleasuring himself with an upside-down turned chair, like one of those Eckerl chairs, and he was lowering himself down onto the chair leg, and he had obviously slipped, impaled himself, managed to pull himself out, laid on the bed for a moment, and then he passed away.
Oh, my God. I wasn't ready for that.
No, but yeah, this is what I mean. Like, all these old people, they're just doing this kinky shit, man.
Well, like your mum's friend, just go get a dildo. Just get a dildo, for the love of God.
No, no. Yes, it's probably better, healthier, but I don't want to think about, especially my family members, using dildos.
I'd rather they use a dildo than a World War II bomb.
That's true. That's true. Can you imagine if one of those things detonated? How do you explain that to your family member? Hey, it's Kyle here. I've got a quick favour to ask you. If you enjoy listening to the Compendium podcast, there is one simple way that you can help show your support. Just hit that follow button in the app that you're listening to us through right now. This year, we're putting everything into making the Compendium better for you. And the only thing we'll ever ask you to do is to hit that follow button or leave us a review. It really helps our show more than we can probably articulate, and is the one thing that you can do to help us spend even more time with you guys. We really appreciate it. Now, let's get back to the show.
Yeah, it's not going to be great, is it? And yeah, well, that's all the latest things for this week.
So, Adam, tell me all about Roald Dahl.
Well, Roald Dahl, and that actually is his birth name. That's not like a stage name or anything like that.
Where did it come from?
He's English. He was born in Cardiff in Wales, but he had Norwegian parents, mm-hmm. which explains the name. And he was named after Norwegian polar explorer Roald Amundsen.
Okay.
Dahl's father was a prosperous shipbroker and self-made. He immigrated to the UK from Sarpsborg, Norway, and settled in Cardiff during the 1880s with his first wife. Together, they had two children before his wife died. So Roald Dahl's father remarried and had Roald Dahl, and they had another two children as well. One of the other children, Roald's sibling, Astrid, died of appendicitis at the age of 7, which hit their father very hard. So much so that Roald Dahl knew that Astrid was his dad's favourite, even from a very early age.
Oh, that's tough, isn't it? That's not nice.
Yeah, and I don't think he harboured any resentment, but it was kind of clear to him. And so when Astrid died and then the dad didn't take it very well, the dad ended up dying of pneumonia only a few weeks later. And so he left this huge fortune of $7 million in today's money to his mother and the rest of his siblings.
Because obviously he was working as a shipbroker, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
And his father said that a British education was one of the best in the world, which is why his family remained in England.
I see.
So he didn't have the best childhood, which is kind of a common or running theme.
Oh, why? Because daddy didn't love him.
Well, that obviously, yeah, that perhaps affected him. But he was sent to boarding school and he caused a lot of mischief at school with teachers. When he was 8 years old, he, along with four friends, received a caning from the headmaster for placing a dead mouse in a container of gobstoppers at the nearby sweet shop. So for those that don't know, they're like these giant sweets that you try and fit in your mouth.
Yeah, who doesn't know what a gobstopper is?
Well, I don't know if they're common across the world, but anyway.
Are we saying that's what gave him the impression that he's had a terrible childhood? Oh, I got spanked once.
Well, no, not just that.
I mean, try getting hit with a belt.
Did you?
Oh my God, man, I used to get the worst beatings. The absolute worst beatings. It made me who I am.
Oh, God.
Strong, will, determined, disciplined.
Disciplined?
Yeah.
Okay.
So he had a bad childhood. He got whacked a few times. I mean, that just sounds like kid stuff. And by the way, he's at boarding school at 8 years old. Damn, that's young, eh?
Yeah. Well, this sweet shop where he hid the dead mouse was owned by a woman called Mrs. Pratchett, who Dahl describes as mean and loathsome.
Okay.
And actually, it was her who inspired headmistress Miss Trunchbull in Matilda.
Oh, is she? Yeah, God, she's a ghastly woman, isn't she? Handsome, ghastly woman.
And these authority figures during Dahl's school years that he didn't really get along with, they would then be used in these characterizations in his book. Mm-hmm. And so from 1929, at the age of 13, Roald Dahl began attending another school in Derbyshire. And in his autobiography, A Boy, Tales of Childhood, Dahl recounts this incident where he witnessed his friend Michael being brutally caned by headmaster Geoffrey Fisher. Reflecting on this, Dahl hated the violence he witnessed during his school years.
God.
And this incident actually led him to have doubts about religion and God, because it was a very religious school. And he was just like, how could you do this to kids?
Yeah.
This is not nice. And this brutality of the caning and overall hostility from the headmaster towards children influenced the antagonists in his book, The Witches, where he referred to children as revolting.
Oh, that's such a great, great story of his, The Witches. I love that one, because that's one with a little mouse, right? Mm. He gets turned into a mouse. And I always remember the live action kind of replay of that one.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite films.
Ah, just then, you obviously spoke quite fondly. I think these kind of stories is what resonated with children. I guess these kind of bad figures are told the story from the perspective of the children a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And a slight side note, but fun fact, Dahl's headmaster, Geoffrey Fisher, would go on to be the Archbishop of Canterbury and officiated not only the wedding of Queen Elizabeth II, but also crowned her at her coronation service.
Shut up. Yeah. Incredible.
So that's a nice, I don't know, connection, tenuous link.
Yeah.
So at school, Dahl certainly had no ambitions or interest in becoming a writer. He wasn't actually even considered that talented at school. One of his English teachers remarked that Dahl consistently wrote words meaning the opposite of what they intended.
Mm-hmm.
And during his time at Repton School, Cadbury's Chocolate occasionally sent boxes of new chocolates to the school for taste testing mm-hmm. and getting customer feedback. And Dahl dreamed of inventing a chocolate bar that would impress Mr. Cadbury, inspiring Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Really? Mm. Actually, I don't know if you're already going to cover this, but I did hear the other day that when Cadbury's was happening, they actually built, I think it's called, they built like an entire village called Bourneville. And it's a real life place where that's where they would produce all the Cadbury chocolates.
Yes.
And they did a lot of research as well into like new chocolates and things like that. And they would use the local primary schools for taste testers.
Mm.
And he was a taste tester for chocolate, where they would get him in and they would be like, what do you taste? What? I mean, it sounds like work, really, because they're like, what flavors are coming through? And they're like, chocolate? yeah, but what flavors and aromas? Chocolate? No. Think about it. Okay. Chocolate?
Milky?
But I think they were looking for kind of like the emotions that were being evoked and stuff.
Yeah.
Were you going to cover that?
No.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, he was like a chocolate taster.
Mm.
Yeah. Incredible.
According to his autobiography, his mum offered to pay for him to study at Oxford or Cambridge after he graduated school. But he was like, nope, that's it. I'm done. I'm off to the world of work. And so he goes on a expedition in 1932 where he goes to Newfoundland and Canada. He has to face these harsh weather conditions, I guess exploring, going on this massive adventure. But then he accepted a job at Shell Oil in 1934 where he worked in Kenya and Tanzania in Africa until 1939. But then what happened in 1939?
The war?
Yeah.
Did the war start in 1939? I always think it's 1940 or something, but...
Yeah, it started in 1939, so he was enlisted in the Royal Air Force, and this is where his life gets a bit more surreal. He trained as a fighter pilot in Nairobi, Kenya, and became a pilot officer, and they were desperate for pilots. As Dahl was 6'6", he was quite lanky, and it's described that he had to curl up into this fetal position with his knees tucked tightly under his chin in order to sit in the cockpit.
Really? Wow.
But they needed pilots, essentially, so it didn't really matter shape or size. And him, along with 16 other men that trained at this facility, only three of them actually survived the war. One of them was Dahl.
Wow. That's horrible, watching all your comrades kind of get murdered.
Incredibly, he was given the ability to fly solo after just 7 hours and 40 minutes.
Was he the first black man to travel solo around the globe?
That's a friend's quote, just to anyone that's going, what? But yeah, 7 hours and 40 minutes. And I know it's war. You probably don't have the luxury of time to, you know, do everything right. But that is a very short amount of time. Can you remember what you were like after your 8th driving lesson?
No.
Well, yeah.
No. Sorry, no, I can't remember.
We're not good enough to drive, clearly.
Oh, okay. Hey, I mean, I really drew out my driving lessons just because my driving instructor was just awesome.
Yeah.
So I was like, I never want to pass. I just want to drive around with you all day. We'd go to Yarmouth. We'd have some chips. We'd drive back. I'd always get free lessons. And I just did not want to pass my test.
Oh.
Segway.
driving lessons are so expensive these days. I don't think you'd do that now.
To be fair, they were really expensive back in my day anyway. It was like 20 quid.
Oh, really?
Yeah. How much were yours?
Oh, mine was like 16, 17. I drove with Ray.
Good old Ray.
He's a good guy.
My actual driving instructor actually lives on the estate.
Really? Where were you?
Yeah, she lives somewhere down that way. And I see her occasionally. And the connection that we had when we were driving together was strong, right?
Mm.
She barely even looks at me now.
Yeah.
She sees me. She knows. We know. Like, I'm like, we shared history, man.
I bet she's like, oh, God, that's a guy that just would not quit driving school.
Maybe you're right. God. I could just not pass him. But yeah, she like doesn't even look at me twice anymore.
I guess it was quite a while ago. 15 years, whatever.
Yeah.
Mm. So back to Dahl. He had this very short time to learn how to fly a plane. They didn't let him go into battles, as far as I'm aware. He just had to fly things back and forth. But he did get some further training in Iraq in a bigger plane. And this was when he was commissioned as a pilot officer. And he joined this squadron, which would allow him to go into battle in August 1940. Albeit, Dahl was kind of surprised that he didn't receive any specialized training in aerial combat or flying the Gladiator plane, which was like this type of aircraft that he flew. So training wasn't great by the sounds of
things. So he was just like, oh, here's a plane, go off and do what you need to do. He's like, hang on a minute, what am I doing? Where am I going?
Yeah, just press this button, shoot this. I don't know, he wasn't given much training.
I guess they were desperate soldiers back then.
Yeah, it was conscription, so everyone had to join.
Oh, God.
On September 19th, 1940, Dahl received orders to fly his Gladiator from Abu Sir near Ismailia in Egypt to his squadron's airstrip located 30 miles south of Mersa Mutra. Not quite sure where those places are, but that's where he had to go.
You just said Egypt.
Well, yes, but I don't know exactly within Egypt. But during the final part of the journey, he encountered difficulties locating the airstrip. And with fuel running low and nightfall approaching, he was forced to make an emergency landing in the desert. And whilst attempting to land, the undercarriage struck a boulder, causing the aircraft to violently crash. Dahl manages to push open the cockpit canopy and escape, crawling out from further harm from the explosion of the plane's fuel tanks and the subsequent machine gun fire unleashed by the heat.
Wow.
And whilst he managed to escape that explosion, he did suffer a fractured skull, a smashed nose, as well as losing his sight. And he falls unconscious.
Oh, hang on, like he's blind.
Well, initially he is blind,
I see.
And he's just incredibly lucky to survive at this point. But fortunately, he is rescued and he is taken to a hospital. This awful event and head injury that Roald Dahl received, he actually attributes to his creativity and what would set him on his path to becoming a famous writer.
What do you mean?
Well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
But whilst in hospital, he regains consciousness and he doesn't get his sight back for a further 6 weeks. So it's a very severe injury and he had this swelling on the brain.
So it was a brain injury, not like a problem with his sight?
I guess so. Yeah, that's causing the loss of sight.
Is this where you then tell me while he is delirious in his hospital bed, he receives, just like Ty Warner did with the Beanie Babies, a vision from an Oompa Loompa. An Oompa Loompa, doopity-doo. You need to become an author.
That was wonderful. No, unfortunately not. Not that I'm aware of.
Oh, man, every genius or every notable person needs an origin story, and it always needs to come from a vision, a delirious vision.
Well, a plane crash and a severe head injury. I think that's enough.
Oh, I need an Oompa Loompa.
He's eventually discharged from hospital with a full bill of health and rejoins his squadron near Athens. He is involved in various aerial battles where he gets to shoot down the enemies in the skies. Mm-hmm. The most famous battle Dahl was involved in was the Battle of Athens on April the 20th, 1941, where he would become a flying ace by taking down five enemy aircrafts. And so that is the quota you have to take down in order to be called an ace.
An ace, okay.
Yeah. But his squadron during this battle was severely outnumbered and it was almost a suicide mission. Also, Dahl was with one of the most famous British Commonwealth flying aces of World War II. And get this, his name was Marmaduke Thomas St. John Paton.
What a name! I mean, any name with Marmaduke in it just elevates me.
Yeah, but he didn't want to go by that. He went by Pat.
Oh, God. Why would you do that to yourself?
He's Pat Paddle. I guess that's maybe easier to say over the radio. Hey, Marmaduke, St. John, Thomas, blah, 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 Paddle. Hey, Pat.
I would make people say my full name. Absolutely. As cultural man, you say my full name.
So you would ignore people and they're like giving you a nickname. You're like, nope, full name me, please.
Yeah, I wouldn't even acknowledge it.
Wow.
I'd be like, my name is Marmaduke, whatever, whatever, whatever. It's a strong name.
Yeah, it's a great name. So this guy had taken down five airplanes or more in one day on multiple occasions. So he was a really good pilot. Mm-hmm. It was suspected that he took down 50 to 60 enemy planes in total by 1941, only within a couple of years of the war starting. And I think he's possibly the highest scoring ace in World War II.
Even today? Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. And the reason I'm talking about Pat, or Marmaduke.
Yeah, why focus on Pat, man? What about Roll?
What I'm trying to say is he was a very good pilot. Mm-hmm. But during this battle, Pat dies. And so the fact that Darl manages to survive this aerial battle suggests that he's a pretty good pilot himself. Mm-hmm. Because he describes an endless blur of enemy fighters whizzing around, like shooting and everything. And he survives all this. So good old Roll. Now, the injuries he had endured from his earlier crash would go on to cause crippling headaches and periodic blackouts. And so he had to have a hip replacement and surgery to his spine on multiple occasions throughout his life.
Yeah.
His blackouts, of course, meant it was too dangerous for him to continue flying. So with his flying wings clipped, Darl was reassigned in 1942 to a diplomatic post, which I think just means office space work, at the British Embassy in Washington, D.C.
Sure.
Initially, Darl found it very weird. It was a striking contrast to where he had been. Because at this point, the US, I don't think, were in the war.
Mm-mm.
And so he found his work mostly unimportant.
Well, like clerical, just boring.
Yeah. He'd just come from war. People were getting killed. He'd been flying around, seeing horrific things. And now he found himself in the middle of a pre-war cocktail party in America.
So you're saying that he missed the kind of the glory of being a soldier?
I think he just felt guilty, like, well, you've stationed me overseas. I'm over here now, and mm-hmm. I know all my friends are fighting. My family's in the UK being bombed. This doesn't feel right.
Yeah, no, I get that you want to be with your people, right? Mm.
But while in Washington, he was encouraged to start writing propaganda for the UK and Allied forces by an author called C.S. Forster.
Mm-hmm.
Forster believed Darl's wartime adventures would captivate the readership of the Saturday Evening Post with its pro-British sentiment. So Darl offered to write an article himself called Shot Down Over Libya, which was a lie. He wasn't shot down, but it was decided it sounded more dramatic than his original name for the article, which was Piece of Cake. So, yeah, this article garnered a lot of attention, propelling Darl into the social spotlight, where he was invited to all these parties and events by these influential figures of American high society.
So were these stories that he was writing, was this just a one-off piece, or was he writing quite a lot of these different stories as propaganda?
I think he was writing quite a few, but I think this particular article is what pushed him forward and got his name out there.
The idea of these articles to be kind of like uplifting and we're winning the war and like heroic we are, and whether or not it's true or not didn't really factor into it, or wasn't that important?
There was another angle from this writing as well, because his work caught the eye of a spy master called William Stevenson. Now, Stevenson was a Canadian millionaire businessman with interests in steel, aircraft manufacturing, and construction. As a result, he had many contacts in the US as well as Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And his European contacts were only too happy to spill the beans on Germany's secret military and industrial buildup prior to the war. And so in 1936, Stevenson began passing on confidential information about the Nazis' activities to Winston Churchill.
Are we talking like, oh, he owns like a steel factory, so, oh, the Nazis have purchased X amount of steel to be shipped over and things like that, you mean? So they got a clue as to what they were building and what infrastructure they were kind of creating.
Yeah, it's revealing, I guess, any ideas and secrets that maybe could reveal what the Germans were after and what they were building and conspiring against.
I see.
So Churchill knew quite early on, if the Allies were to win the war, they needed US involvement. And many people in the United States didn't want to join the war. But secretly, a Franklin D. Roosevelt agreed with Churchill. He thought, actually, we probably are going to have to get involved. To change people's minds and get them to support Britain, Churchill asked William Stevenson for help.
Mm-hmm.
And Stevenson quickly gathered a group of spies in New York's Rockefeller Center, and they pretended to work for the British Passport Office, but actually they were working for the British Security Coordination, who did a number of things to help convince the US to join the war,
mm-hmm.
one of which was creating a fake map showing that the Nazis planned to invade South America. And President Roosevelt talked about this fake map in Congress to show how dangerous Hitler was. It made a lot of Americans change their minds and want to try and stop Hitler.
Do you know what? So they had their own agenda to fill. They wanted to get involved in the war because, of course, we know what happened after the war with mm-hmm. America kind of then creating global dominance and pegging the dollar to it. So they manufactured this just to get their way, to fool the people. And this happens all the time though, doesn't it?
That's the thing. Just think about the current political climate, right? Yeah. The wars in Ukraine and Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying everything we're being fed to is a lie, but there's potentially some information that we're being given that might be, I don't know, massaging or exaggerating a truth, or trying to get those that are perhaps a bit more neutral or more hesitant to get involved. It's adding another layer that might not be strictly true.
Yeah.
And it probably happens more than we want to admit.
I think it happens all the time.
Mm. So back to this spy ring by Stevenson. He convinced famous people like business tycoons, actors, playwrights, and future writers such as Roald Dahl, as well as Ian Fleming, the author who would go on to write James Bond.
Really?
To join this group called the Irregulars.
That's such like a superhero kind of like name, isn't it? The yeah. Irregulars.
Yeah. I think there's been like TV shows where they've kind of used this concept as group of misfits that come together to take down something. So apparently that's what they were called back then. Ian Fleming said that James Bond was a compound of all the secret agents and commando types he met during the war, maybe even him himself to some extent. But some suspect that maybe Roald Dahl was part of that inspiration behind James Bond.
Wow, that's so cool. And it also provides credibility to that persona of who we think James Bond is, that in a way it's rooted from real life experiences and observations.
Yes, yeah.
That's like how it all works.
Yeah, because we think of James Bond probably being a bit old fashioned and, you know, of a previous time, the older movies, not necessarily the ones with Daniel Craig. So you can kind of see those characteristics would come from someone or perhaps the war.
Yeah.
And it's not to say this is all Roald Dahl, absolutely not. But Roald Dahl was described as a handsome man.
Mm-hmm.
He was naturally very good at talking to people and making them like him. He had this charisma and charm that would be used to influence high society, as well as journalists and politicians, as well as the wives of these powerful men.
Oh, really?
He was known as quite the bedhopper.
Was he? Mm-hmm. Oh, like, no, James. Yes. No, James. Yes. No, James. Yes. Okay, three. Three no's means yes.
Yeah.
Is that how it goes?
What Something is that? Like that. I think in Family Guy, yeah. So Roald Dahl was seducing these women, and it was kind of an open secret. And in fact, someone connected to this business tycoon even commented that girls just fell at Roald's feet. I think he slept with everybody on the East and West Coast that was worth more than $50,000 a year.
What does that mean? So he was a gold digger. He liked to sleep with really rich, affluent women.
Yes, because these women would be married potentially or involved in these big, you know, people of power. And so he was trying to get to those by seducing the wives.
Oh, I see. What an angle.
Wow. Yeah. One of his most dangerous missions was to try to charm a lady named Claire Booth Luce. Her husband was...
Claire a bit loose?
Well, actually, there is a rumour that she was in an open marriage, which is why it was kind of okay, I guess.
So she had a loose booth.
A loose
booth.
About this hoose.
Hoose in the booth? What?
The sweets from... Oh, you weren't here. You were in Africa.
Running in the wild plains of Africa. Yeah, that's me.
Yeah. It was like a sweet advert. Never mind.
Oh, okay. Completely over my head.
Yeah.
What is it?
What was it? Is moose, hoose about this? Oh, a moose, loose about this hoose?
That sounds like a Scottish thing. Is there a mouse loose in this house?
Something. I don't know. Yeah. It was just advertised sweets. I think it was Chewits. I don't know.
Random.
What was my point?
Back to Roald Dahl.
Yeah. So this Claire Booth Luce, her husband was Henry Luce, the man who founded Time, Life and Fortune magazines in America.
Oh, wow.
So he was really influential, and he was all about putting America first. And he was totally against helping Britain and actually despised us.
He
wasn't a fan. So the plan was, if Dahl could seduce his wife, the hope was that he could get information about Henry that they could use to blackmail or discredit his writing in these magazines.
Right, I see. I mean, because if it doesn't go right, this is a one way to piss him off, and he's a powerful man, this Mr. Luce.
Now, it's not clear how successful this mission was, but Claire, in particular, proved to be almost too much for Roald Dahl. Dahl had underestimated Luce's sexual appetite.
Oh, God.
This led to what is probably one of the wildest things for Roald Dahl's bosses to ever hear. So he called them up and he said, "I am all effed out. That goddamn woman has absolutely screwed me from one end of the room to the other for three goddamn nights."
Well, he's clearly gay if he's moaning about it.
Well, he begged to be given a different mission because it was too much. He can't do it anymore. But being a true British man, you know, with a stiff upper lip, so to speak,
he pioneered through.
He basically knew how important the work was, and he championed on.
Wow.
So yeah, things you had to do for king and country back then.
Outstanding.
He became very good friends with a lot of these powerful men in America, including getting close to the vice president. He would go and play tennis with him. He got to know the actual president, Franklin Roosevelt. And Roald Dahl supposedly revealed to the UK that the president was interested in sleeping with a Norwegian princess at the time who had sought asylum in America. So he apparently leaked that.
Wow.
He also, again, allegedly, I can't corroborate this, told the UK that the US was looking to go to the moon. And so this was back in the 40s.
Wow. Okay.
Together with Stevenson, Dahl helped change Americans' minds and made them want to support the war. Although I think Pearl Harbor was probably the biggest catalyst for that.
I think so.
But I guess these sneaky tricks and strategic friendships with important people helped to at least get information to the UK to help them and get some sort of buying power.
God, it goes to show you the power of propaganda, right? And how important it is.
Absolutely. Dahl's first children's book was actually written during the war, and it was called The Gremlins. It was published in 1943. It was a story about mythical creatures that could cause trouble for Royal Air Force pilots.
Mm-hmm.
And that came from his time flying, where pilots, when things go wrong with their planes, they would just say, oh, it's the gremlins.
Yeah.
And so that's where that came from.
Yeah, for sure. Because I think there's an episode of The Simpsons where I think Bart or Homer looks out the window and they see like a gremlin like messing around with the wings or something like that.
Yeah.
And I've always grown up knowing that was a gremlin, like a gremlin on a plane or messing around with machinery and stuff.
Yeah, so it kind of originates from this, I think. The book received really good reviews, a lot of popularity, and Walt Disney even wanted to make a movie about it back then, but it didn't really happen. But in 1984, there was a movie called The Gremlins, mm-hmm. which was produced by Steven Spielberg. And that was loosely inspired by some of Dahl's creatures.
So cool.
Yeah. After the war, he continued to write, but the focus was not on children's books straight away. He was involved with TV and film. He even wrote the screenplay for James Bond, You Only Live Twice.
Mm-hmm.
And also Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Oh, well, how does the song go?
Well, you're kind of there. We love you. Oh.
Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, we love you. I don't know.
It's close enough.
Please grab that bit out.
I never realized he wrote movies as well. He marries an actress called Patricia Neal. I think she was a famous actress at the time. He had 5 children with her. On December the 5th, 1960, his 4-month-old son Theo sustained severe injuries when his baby carriage was struck by a taxi in New York City.
Oof.
He subsequently suffered from hydrocephalus, which is when fluid accumulates in the brain and can cause brain damage.
Damn.
This incident prompted Dahl's involvement in the development of the Wade-Dahl-Till valve, a device co-created with Stanley Wade and Kenneth Till, hence the name, aimed at improving the way to treat this condition in order to drain excess fluid from the brain.
Like a literal tap on the head.
I guess so.
I did have a look at it.
It looked, yeah, like you drained it.
Shut up.
Yeah.
I just said that from like top of my head. Well, I didn't know that's what it looked like.
Because it was a valve and it's draining liquid.
Mm.
Yeah. By the time the device that they'd created was perfected, his son fortunately had healed to the point.
Oh, he healed.
So that's good news. But the device, whilst his son didn't need it, was still used successfully in nearly 3,000 children worldwide. Dahl and the other 2 men never agreed to accept any profits from it. It was all noble.
That's great.
Mm.
He's such a great guy. I'm surprised that he spent that much of his life in the States after, is the war over by now?
Yeah, that was 1960 that happened.
So I'm surprised he spent so much of his life in the USA. I thought he would have come home.
Maybe he was traveling, I don't know why. But then his wife was a famous actress, so who knows. I think he lived mainly in the UK afterwards.
Okay.
Sadly, Dahl suffers from more heartbreak when his daughter Olivia passes away at the age of 7 due to measles in 1962. Her death profoundly affects him, leaving him overwhelmed with despair and guilt for his inability to help her. So he becomes an advocate for immunization, publishing Measles, a Dangerous Illness in 1988 in response to the outbreak in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And he dedicates his book, The BFG, to his daughter.
Oh, the big friendly giant.
Yeah.
Oh.
His most notable work didn't really kick off until the 60s and into the 80s, where he writes Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Matilda, James and the Giant Peach, The Witches, Fantastic Mr. Fox, The BFG, The Twits, and George's Marvelous Medicine.
Wow, these are all huge names. And he wrote all those within 20 years.
Pretty much, yeah. And I think a lot of these stories, they center around that child's point of view. They have these villainous grown-up characters, yeah, mistreat kids, but there's always like one nice adult to help them
That's
out.
That's it. I was going to say that, like, the thing that unifies all these stories is that it's the kids that are always hard done by, right? There's always someone out to get the kids because adults are typically seen as the evil, darker ones, but there's always one ally or two amongst the grown-ups.
Yes.
So it's crazy.
Yeah.
It also kind of highlights this idea that as you get older, innocence dies, and with it, sometimes morality dies. You lose that sense of morality and you become this evil adult.
Yeah, because it was. It was always these good kids winning over bad adults.
Are you so great?
Now, when most people think of Roald Dahl, they think of those kind of scratchy sketches by Quentin Blake. But in fact, he didn't actually start working with Roald Dahl until 1976. And so once that happened, I think that's when his drawings become synonymous with Roald Dahl's work.
Yeah, because if I had to sum up the drawings from a lot of these books, there's a grotesqueness, isn't there? Like the long spindly fingers, lanky, kind of like really sharp noses, a very illustrative but grotesque at the same time.
Yes, yeah.
It's so incredible and so iconic.
Yeah, and this success, he says it was pretty much it was a fluke that he was even writing in the first place, because he wouldn't have done it had he not been asked to write those articles when he was in America. Also, he says that I doubt I would have written a line unless some minor tragedy sort of twisted my mind out of the normal rut. And so his work all came from that, I guess, plane crash in terms of that
trauma.
Creativity. Yeah. So this bit's kind of gross.
Ooh, I love a gross.
When he later developed an abscess in his back.
Okay, too gross.
His response was not to get a new chair, but to hack a hole in the back of that chair to accommodate the sore.
The things men will do to just not have to go to the doctor just blows my mind. I mean, I get it. Just ignore it. Accommodate it. Treat it with kindness. It will treat you with kindness.
Yeah, actually, I found that quite funny. Also, in his office, there is a hip bone, which Dahl retained after a hip replacement.
Oh, yeah.
And a little jar of spinal shavings, another souvenir from his RAF crash. So it's kind of gross, but I think the whole point was he had these things around him because it was a significant thing that happened to him, and it's a memory that pushed him to do writing.
I mean, I would keep a kidney stone.
Kidney stones.
And kidney stones. I would, if I had a kidney stone or something removed, I would keep it.
Yeah.
Not if it was like a fleshy thing that would rot.
Yeah. I remember my dad's friend had kidney stones, and I remember at Christmas she showed them to me in a little tube, and it was weird. It's just like little bits of gravel.
How big were they?
Like fish gravel, if you imagine. They weren't too big. They were like that sort of size.
Did he pass them naturally? Peed them out?
Oh, I don't know.
I know sometimes they use like some kind of laser to shatter them, don't they? So it makes it easier to pass. But if they're really big, sometimes you have to pass them naturally or you have to have an operation. But
might have been operation, I think.
God, imagine doing that right out your wee hole.
Oh, jeez.
Kidney stones!
So some of his most famous work has now been adapted onto screen multiple times and continues to be adapted, like the most recent Wonka movie. Even though he's written for adults, I don't think he's ever reached the same level of success as he had with his children's books.
Oh, really? What was he written for adults?
There's Wikipedia for that. Not quite sure. There's a few out there. And obviously, he did some like TV adaptations of something with Alfred Hitchcock and a few other things. But if you look through either his bibliography or his kind of filmography, it's primarily the stuff that you'll spot in his kids' books.
Is the kids' stuff, yeah.
He passed away on November the 23rd, 1990, at the age of 74. Due to a rare form of blood cancer, and he was laid to rest in a cemetery in Buckinghamshire. His granddaughter mentioned that the family arranged a ceremony akin to a Viking funeral for him.
Wow.
And he's buried.
So does that mean like they send him off on a raft, and then once he's like 200 meters out, someone gets an arrow with a flame, and they shoot it on him, and then he just bursts into flames,
well, that's
and then
what I
he
thought.
Just sinks.
But then, because he's in a cemetery, and because he was buried with these items that I'm about to read, I don't know what that actually means, but maybe there's just a big fanfare.
A regular run-of-the-mill burial.
Vikings.
Like, being able to say it was a Viking burial just makes it sound cooler, right?
Sound
but
cool.
Actually, in reality, stick in the ground.
Yeah. But the thing that is interesting, I thought, was he was buried with his snooker cues, some fine burgundy wine.
Oh, yeah.
Some chocolates.
Mm-hmm.
HB pencils.
Okay.
And a power saw.
What? And a power saw. So these must be all things that he was really passionate about.
I guess so, yeah. So the power saw, I guess he liked DIY. He liked drawing or writing. And obviously he likes wine and chocolates. Who wouldn't?
Yeah, who doesn't? I mean, it just sounds like run-of-the-mill Viking stuff, you know?
Yeah. even today, children visit his grave. They leave toys and flowers as tokens of admiration.
Where is he buried?
In Buckinghamshire.
So he's back in the UK.
Yeah.
Aw.
But I was interested because I thought they're quite interesting things to be buried with. What would you be buried with?
Oh, goodness. Do you know what? I would be, if I was old, I'd definitely want to be buried with my full set of teeth.
Okay, yeah.
I don't know.
These are mine.
These are mine. I'm dying with all my own teeth. I've made it this far. Interesting. It would be stuff that really means a lot to me, like Keith. Whether or not he's alive or dead, I want him to be buried with me.
Okay.
I don't know why.
That's a what cat,
would you,
by the way.
What about you? What would you be buried with?
I don't know. I haven't really thought about it. I have no idea. So now I'm going to think about that.
Why'd you bring it to the table if you're not coming with anything?
Well, I've got some other ideas for you.
Go on then, give me those ideas.
Here is what some other famous people have been buried with.
Go.
Princess Diana was buried with rosary beads she received from Mother Teresa. She might have been buried with other things, but that was the one thing I found.
That's incredible.
Frank Sinatra was buried with a flask full of Jack Daniels and a pack of Camel cigarettes.
Ooh, that Jack Daniels will be worth a lot of money now, right? Aged.
Bob Marley was allegedly buried with his guitar and some weed.
Nice.
William Wise, some guy who I think was in the US Civil War, was buried with his horse, his favorite hunting dog, and a sword.
Oh, God. Like the ashes of the dog and the horse?
I don't know if they were all with him.
Did the dogs outlive him? Because if the dog didn't outlive him, then that's my case for Keith being buried with us, or with me.
Because it was during the Civil War, I wondered if it was during a battle and perhaps all of them died.
What's his dog doing in battle with him?
I don't know. Help, PA. Yeah.
Take some notes.
Yeah. But he was convinced he was going to hell and wanted to track down and kill Satan. So that's why he had the horse with him.
I see. That's because Satan's notoriously terrified of horses.
Yeah.
No, not the horse!
Or a dog. and Michael Jackson, he was buried with a single...
A bunch of kids!
No. I'll start that again.
Okay.
Michael Jackson was buried with a single white sparkly glove from the Thriller music and stuff like that. So, oh, and Whitney Houston, I've got some from her. She was buried in a gold-lined coffin worth tens of thousands of pounds and supposedly £300,000 worth of jewellery and designer clothes.
Wow. And no crack?
It doesn't say there was any crack.
No cocaine.
No, but I thought, why would you tell people that you've got that in your coffin?
Yeah, exactly. Well, unless it depends where you've been buried, right?
If it's heavily guarded and everything. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, but that just made me think, that's either one, a waste, and two, yeah, someone could come and take that. If they
yeah, eventually, like, what if the cemetery goes out of business or she loses the money to kind of pay for the security or whatever?
Yeah.
Someone turns their head for 5 minutes, boom. That's what we're doing next. Going to go get Whitney Houston's crack and the jewelry.
That's definitely being cut.
don't cut that. I apologize. That was really lowbrow. I love Whitney Houston. She's a brilliant artist, but famously addicted to cocaine.
So before I end the story, one thing I think it's important to note is Dahl has had some controversy surrounding him whilst alive and after.
Yes, yes, he has.
So in the past, he has made some anti-Semitic remarks, particularly around Israelis. And it's hard to defend these remarks. And I'm not going to repeat them because I don't think it's nice. But I will say that he did allude to some odd justification of why Hitler did what he did to the Jews.
Oh, no.
And it was just like, no, what were you even thinking when you said that?
I'm really interested to know what some of the things he did say, if we can say it respectfully.
Some of it, as I said, centered around Israelis. So he talked about how they were in business with certain Americans and all sorts. But he wasn't necessarily disrespectful to all Jewish people. In fact, he had a lot of Jewish friends. He chose to work with them. I think one was his manager.
I mean, that's
manager.
A classic thing, like, I can't be racist because I've got some black friends. It doesn't make you not racist.
Yeah, exactly. I think people say that sometimes he would just be controversial or blow up and make wild remarks on a whim. But I don't know. It's
on a racist rant, like Karl Lagerfeld did.
Yeah, I just don't think, you know, that's cool by any means.
No.
I mean, some of his books have also had some controversy as well. In fact, there were revisions printed last year.
Mm-hmm. Like what?
There are updates made by what they call sensitivity readers.
Okay, so this is going to go too far, in my opinion, sometimes. What are they?
Yes and no. So I think some things that they do make sense, and other things that they take out, I'm a bit like, I don't think that was...
Like what?
They remove references to describe someone as dark, in case that might meant racially dark.
Oh, I see.
But I think in some instances, how I interpreted it was that they were just like an evil person, nothing down
who happened to be African American.
No.
Oh, no.
No, nothing, not that at all.
Oh, so there's no race involved at all?
No. But I think he would be sexist and he would use these racist stereotypes and he might talk about people with disabilities or deformities in his characters that were evil.
Right, I see. Okay. So it's just reinforcing.
Yeah, it's not just Roald Dahl's books that have come under this kind of scrutiny. Even Enid Blyton's and Ian Fleming's books are getting updates off the back of this. Even Goosebumps books have been changed in the past to avoid imagery that could negatively impact a young person's view on themselves and the world today.
Sure.
So it's becoming more common now to update these iconic pieces of literature, which some argue is messing with the original piece of art, which I do get. But I think people and businesses are now more mindful that the world has changed. His stories are so creative that the DNA of those stories can still be told and capture the imagination of these young children today. But you can do that in a way that's not going to offend people.
And is more inclusive.
Exactly.
And is less closed off to certain people.
Yeah. So I think it's fair if we want to retell those stories, let's update them a little bit.
Yes. And do you know what? I completely agree with doing stuff like that. However, I always feel like the reason why it's happening is because there's an avenue to make more money by removing some of that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think you're right there.
Are the people who are in charge of revising these books doing it because it's the right thing to do for inclusivity, or is it just another way of them being able to squeeze a bit more cash and get more of an audience? So it's really interesting because a lot of businesses, they jump onto the whole LGBT Pride Month thing, but it's just another way of them making more money. Do they necessarily care about advancing the rights of gay people?
Yeah, I think these are businesses that are adapting older pieces of work. And I think because if they come under some kind of scrutiny that people have said, like with James Bond, he's misogynistic and everything like that. Now, if they tweak little bits in the wording to say, oh, we've played that down a little bit,
yeah,
then it's still making money at the end of the day, isn't it?
Yeah. I think Dr. Seuss came under the same scrutiny recently, didn't he, as well, where they've updated some of the language that he's used. Because I think he was like notoriously anti-Semitic and racist and things like that as well. So if it's going to be more inclusive and send a better message to young people and not close people off, especially when you are a minority and someone's talking about you, I think absolutely those things should change.
Yeah, I think we can recognize he is a controversial figure in some regards, especially if you look at all the aspects of his life and ideologies. But I think we can agree that what he has contributed to this world is more positive than negative, I think.
For sure. Like when people look back at their childhood, Roald Dahl plays a huge part in that, right? The imagination, the fantasy, the escapism, that you have an adult writing about kind of the integrity and the moralness of young children and innocence. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Like
people always hold that close to them.
Exactly. I think there's a lot of good there. I mean, he's a war hero, a flying ace, a spy, and he's fought for ways to improve children's health through his own adversity. And he's taken a horrific accident and reassessed his life and the sadness he had from his upbringing to create these really wonderful stories for children.
Yeah.
So I hope people can still take that whilst acknowledging some of his behavior is problematic and learn and from that, as we do, as we always should do with history, to move forward.
For sure.
And that, Kyle, is the life story of Roald Dahl.
Roald Dahl. That was very good. Thank you very much. Yeah. I had no idea that he, A, fought in the war, and that he lived that long, that amount of time in America. I didn't realize that he was just so international.
Yeah. What a life that he's had in terms of just things that he's done. I never knew he was a spy. I never knew he couldn't handle more than three nights of sex a week. All this.
I'm shocked that he doesn't have the stamina to deal with Claire Luce. I mean, it's Claire Luce, for God's sake.
He's a legend in a lot of ways, and I think that's quite cool.
Wow. What inspired you to want to do this episode?
I think it's because of the fact that he's a spy. I think it's quite interesting when you look back at people that have a different life to what you knew of them.
Amazing.
Yeah. Should we roll the outro?
Let's do it.
And so we come to the end of another episode of The Compendium, and an assembly of fascinating and intriguing things. If you found today's episode both fascinating and intriguing, then please subscribe and leave us a review. And don't just stop there, schedule your episodes to download automatically. Doing this not only ensures you're up to date, but also boosts our visibility, helping us to serve you even more captivating tales straight to your ears. You can follow us on Instagram at The Compendium Podcast, or visit our home on the web at thecompendiumpodcast.com. We release new episodes every Tuesday, and so until then, remember, when things might seem flagunkled, adversity can spring brilliance. You really can choose a path that will truly be spiffling and gloriumptious.
Aw, Adam, that's cool.
Until next week.
See you later.